Hello, welcome to episode 58 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and we're joined after a long hiatus with lots of baseball and not so much transaction talk by my regular co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, thank you so much for coming back to us after after this long break. Are you enjoying the start of the baseball season?
I am, but you know, I wish another podcast had offered me a more lucrative split contract, and they didn't, so here I am.
Yeah, I don't blame you for wanting to try to find a more exciting option, but we do have transactions to talk about. We wanted to give it some space as the season opened up, see what moves, what disabled list moves, what final kind of signings might trickle through. Still waiting on my Melky Cabrera signing. I don't know why that guy can't seem to find a job, but yeah, we got some stuff to talk through today. But generally speaking, how are you feeling about the start of the season? Is it exciting enough for you, or is there enough going on, enough that you feel like you can talk and write about?
Yeah, I think Shohei Ohtani is definitely providing a lot to talk and write about. And I think, you know, there have been a lot of surprises in the early going. We all expected the Nationals, the Cubs, and the Dodgers to kind of run away with the respective divisions of the National League. And as of today, not a single one of those teams is in first place. In fact, none of them are even in second place. So, you know, it's been a crazy start to the season, at least on the National League side of things. I think the American League's been a little bit more to norm, although I guess I say that the Indians and Astros are both not in first place. So, I don't know. What about you? Anything catching your eye?
Well, as a longtime New York Mets fan, that's got to be the top of the list for me, with the Mets getting out to a 12-3 start. Not what anybody, I think, was expecting that hot of a start to start the season. But you've got a couple of teams who really surged at the beginning of the season. And for the most part, they're teams you kind of would have expected. The Red Sox, the Angels, the Diamondbacks, those are all really good teams that I think, you know, a lot of people pick to be at least in the discussion for wildcard contention for all three of them, if not the favorites for them. I know I had picked the Red Sox and the Angels as my wildcard teams. I know I picked the Diamondbacks as a wildcard team in the National League West, and I picked the Mets as the other wildcard team. So my wildcard picks right now look awesome, but we're halfway through April. So I guess, you know, what's the big deal there?
I can't remember who I picked, but I would agree that all those teams seemed like they should have been in the wild card hunt. And I do remember saying the Mets were my dark horse in the National League, with the Athletics being my dark horse in the American League. So I'm batting 500, Brian.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and hey, if we're talking about baseball, batting 500 is about as good as you can do. I think we even have some players who are batting 500 still on the season this year, or at least pretty close to that. I'm trying to check my leaderboards real quick and see if there's anybody who's still at that level. I think we're pretty much stuck with just Joe Mauer, who's above 400 for the season so far. So good on him.
And we're still early in the season, hence Ryan Flaherty being the third leading hitter and the actual leading hitter in the National League, at least per batting average. So still very, very early in the process.
Well, I mean, you might want to give Yasmani Grandal the spot as the leading hitter. He is one plate appearance behind Flaherty.
That's not how the rules work, Ryan.
I know, and it makes me mad. But yeah, we're seeing some great performances by a few players, some less than great performances by some few players. I cannot believe that Yankees fans are already over Giancarlo Stanton, but that is that's how these early season things go, I guess. You know, maybe you want to have a little bit of patience with your guys who are having a tough row of things at the early season. But yeah, there's a couple of guys who are hitting really well and a couple of guys who are not off to the start we'd kind of hoped, I think.
Yeah, and that's true every, you know, middle of April. And of course, there are also teams out there who are seemingly thinking about selling already, even though tax day was, you know, I guess tax day is actually technically today. So you know, it's always a good sign when your beat writer is reporting about how you should probably go ahead and pack it in, and you haven't even gotten to May. So congratulations, Tampa Bay Rays. You guys are doing something. I don't know if you're doing good, but you're doing something.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the Rays talking about selling now is one of the least shocking things I've heard, because the Tampa Bay Rays were thinking about selling, you know, in, I don't know, I think that process might have started at the end of last season, so it shouldn't come as a super surprise to anybody. No. But what can you do? It's nice to see Bryce Harper hitting like a like an MVP candidate again. I mean, that's a positive. He's hitting almost as well as Didi Gregorius is, so that's good for him.
Kevin Towers is right about Didi Gregorius. Never forget that.
That's a really, really important thing to say. In hindsight, we kind of bashed that in the sabermetric community pretty early, with the whole Trevor Bauer going to Cleveland and Didi Gregorius coming to the Diamondbacks, and in hindsight, that looks like Towers might have the old gunslinger might have known what he was doing there. It's just it's pretty weird that he eventually ended up on the Yankees.
Yeah, and that shows Brian Cashman knows what he's doing as well, because to make that trade for Gregorius, and there was gonna be a lot of pressure in Gregorius replacing Jeter regardless, but the first year there he really didn't hit much more than he had hit in Arizona, and after that you've seen incremental improvements every step of the way, and I don't think any of us expected him to ever have 120 home run season, let alone. He had 45 home runs between 2016 and 2017, and he's off to three, excuse me, he's off to a solid enough start this year with 3-14 games. So we could be talking about Didi Gregorius having, what, 70 plus home runs over a 3-year span. I don't think I ever expected that. So, if Towers did, credit to him.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that he had three over X number of games. Last night he hit two more, so he's up to five home runs, and he now leads baseball in slugging.
Hey, Didi Gregorius, folks. And he's such a fun player to watch. I mean,
Oh,
even when he
yeah.
came up, he had that, fantastic arm, solid to good defense. And he was just a blast to watch. So it's really cool to see him develop into this, all-star caliber shortstop who, he stays on the field for the most part, and he just seems like a likable individual in general. So it's really cool to see that happen.
Yeah. So Gregorius now has a triple slash line of 327, 446, 796 over the season.
Jeez, Luis.
So I mentioned Didi Gregorius is the top dog in terms of slugging in all of baseball right now, as far as regular players go. The guy who's number two on the list is somebody we need to talk about today, and probably is considered our big move of the day, because the number two guy on the list is the Rockies' Charlie Blackmon. He's got a pretty impressive 784 slugging percentage himself. And Blackmon inked to an extension with the Rockies, kind of something I was a little bit surprised about, given that the Rockies are ostensibly going to need to not only offer him some sort of extension, but if they want to keep Nolan Arenado, they're going to have to offer an extension to him as well, lest he hit the free agent market, I think. But let's talk a little bit about Blackmon and his extension. So his extension is going to run through 2021. It's going to guarantee him, I believe it's $77 million. But there's some, pretty impressive club options for 2022 and 2023 afterwards. Charlie Blackmon has kind of turned into this MVP adjacent caliber of player. He does a lot of things really, really well. What are your thoughts on him in this extension?
Well, it's pair player options, which makes it sort of like an opt-out situation without calling it an opt-out situation. But you're right, Blackmon has turned into a brilliant hitter. I mean, just dating back since 2016, he's hit something like 326, 390, 584. That's, an average of 24 home runs per season. He's stolen 11 bases per season, and of course, we're still in progress here, so that number is going to go up. But he is, basically like a prototypical leadoff guy, except he's also got the chance to hit nearly 40 home runs like he did last season. So he's a really impressive hitter. I don't think he's bad in center field. I don't know if you'd say, he's above average or whatever, but he's certainly, respectable there. That is, like you said, an MVP, a near MVP caliber player. And so I was surprised to see him settle for this deal because, you would expect him to play out the season and see if someone would come calling on the open market. But I guess he likes Colorado, and maybe the combination of turning 32 in July and having played all of his home games in Colorado made him think his market wouldn't necessarily be as fruitful as it should be based on his performance. I really don't know, but I was surprised to see him stay with the Rockies on an extension like this. And it feels like, maybe this is a team-friendly deal. I don't know. Maybe I'm overvaluing Blackmon during his decline phase, but the average, what was the average qualifying offer this year? Something like 17 million.
Yeah, a little over 17.
And the most Lachman can make through this deal in a single season is $21 million, and he'll make that at least three times, potentially four, if he exercises his first player option for the 2022 season. So, right now, I feel like you can say Blackman's probably a five-ish win player to get him on $21 million, for the next few years. I know, again, he's in this decline phase and whatnot, but I don't know. I feel like that might actually be a discount, assuming the market bounces back to where it was before last winter.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at this in comparison to the Lorenzo Cain signing, and we were very positive about the Cain signing. Cain is younger. Cain is a better defensive player, but Blackman is very clearly, it seems like, the better hitter. I know his numbers get a little bit inflated for playing in Colorado, but when you adjust things for his league and his home park, he is still an incredible hitter. 37 home runs in Colorado is still a huge amount of power. He has hit for a great batting average at pretty much at every stop in the minors and the majors. And one of the things that's kind of interesting is he keeps kind of nudging up his walk rate as he gets older, which is a really great sign. Yeah, you're supposed to do that, but not everybody does. He tends to be pretty durable. He's put in over 150 games over three of the last four seasons. He's a really, really nice ball player, and I really like him. And I think that eventually, the Rockies moving him to left or right field to make room for David Dahl or Tapia or somebody else, it's going to leave them with a really strong outfield. So I really like this move for the Rockies. I am a little surprised. I know the free agent market was a little wonky last offseason, but I'm a little surprised that he wouldn't try it and see if he could get a little bit more. Even if he really wants to play in Colorado, maybe he could have touched up his offer a little bit by going into the open market. I'm sure it has to do with his age and for him being basically an age 32 player, but still, I would have wanted him to risk it for himself because I think he could have gotten, maybe even an earlier opt out, maybe a little bit more cash if he would have waited to bided his time a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that's discouraging if this becomes a trend. You don't want to see players who are on the verge of free agency signing these deals that, even though they might be somewhat close to market value, they're still probably under market value.
Oh,
Because,
for sure.
people talk about, is this going to be something that players do now? Are they scared of free agency? Well, if players are scared of going to free agency, especially players like Charlie Blackman, who have earned MVP votes in both of the last two seasons, then we have big problems. And so, if teams are basically weaponizing free agency against players of this caliber or of any caliber, then the league is in a lot of trouble. And we're not going to be talking about baseball for many more for much longer, because there's going to be some serious labor strife. So I'm hoping this was just one of these weird occurrences where, he loves Colorado. They made an offer he felt was competitive. He doesn't want to move his family or whatever, and so he just wanted to go ahead and get security. But yeah, it's concerning on its face, and I hope that this doesn't become a trend going forward.
Yeah, me too. So I want to talk a little bit about the Rockies, the National League West. They're only 2.5 games behind the Diamondbacks in the West. I think we all kind of talked about them as, if not a flat out sure thing for the National League wild card, but a strong, strong contender this year. Obviously, this move should make them better or keep them viable in the long term. But this is now a team that's carrying a lot of payroll and a few guys. And going forward, I'm a little nervous about how this affects the team because next year, Nolan Arenado is going to be in his last year of arbitration. But this past year, he already made almost $18 million on his own. DJ LeMahieu, possibly the most underrated player in baseball still, although he hasn't had quite the same level of performance as he did in 2016, is going to be a free agent. And this team is carrying some pretty serious. Oh, and John Gray is hitting his first year of arbitration, which I think is going to make a difference for him. So is Trevor Story, who has the home runs, who at least draw some cash in arbitration. I don't see how this team is able to bring back both Arenado and LeMahieu unless they spend a pretty substantial amount of money, even with guys like Gerardo Parra and Ian Desmond's contract diminishing a little bit next year. This is a team that doesn't seem like one that's usually going to run huge payroll, so I don't know if this move might preclude them from if not bringing back Arenado, at least not bringing back DJ LeMahieu.
Yeah, I have to assume LeMahieu is going to go. And I do agree, he is very underrated. I don't think people give him enough consideration because he's a contact hitter who plays in Coors Field. And there's generally, this feeling that anyone who produces good numbers in Coors Field, who maybe isn't a masher, is perhaps overrated and, just taking advantage of those deep alleyways and whatnot. But I like him. And I think he's going to make a very good addition for some team this winter, especially with his glove. I mean, he's a very good defender at the Keystone. But beyond that, I don't really know what the Rockies have in mind there because they do, in theory, have Ryan McMahon, who they could try to round the infield. Maybe they slot him in at second base or whatnot. They have Brendan Rodgers coming. I have to assume that, Story honestly could be a non-tender candidate at some point, right? I mean, I know he was brilliant, and he obviously has, a good amount of thump in that bat, but he was not that great last season. And I've always had, I guess I should say I've always been kind of a skeptic of his approach, and I mean literally his approach at the plate. I don't know if he's worth. I don't know. He was like a. I guess if you like his defense, he's fine, but. If he has a if he continues this rough start, even if he doesn't, I think they might end up moving on from him before the start of next season. So there's some cost savings there. I keep going back to the Ian Desmond signing, and I don't think it really made sense at the time, but you're right. I mean, he's going to make $22 million this season, $15 million in both 2019 and 2020. Then it slopes back down to $8 million in 2021, and that looks like a major misstep now. It looked like a misstep then, but it looks even worse now because. I mean, he's just been so bad. And, even when he was signed, he had not really put together an impressive amount of production in, recent years. It was basically like a one-half thing for him in Texas. So I don't know. I was confused about that then. I'm confused about it now. And I would hate to think that would have cost them, one of these ever players, but it might really do that unless they're going to continue to, flex their payroll in ways that perhaps we don't expect them to do because they entered the season with a mark near like 140 million, the highest in franchise history. And to their credit, they've continuously raised it over the last few years. But how much higher can it go? I really don't know the answer to that. So I guess we'll have to find out. But I just hope the Ian Desmond deal doesn't cost them, someone who's part of this core.
Well, and the thing that kind of goes with this, I think, is that the Rockies are in a position where, coming into this season, when I made my predictions, I predicted them to miss the playoffs. I predicted them to not quite be good enough to make the wild card. And I think the part of the reason of that is that they have a lot of really good, interesting young pitching, but it's not a given that it's going to be able to hold up. I think that this is a team that if they're in contention come the middle of the season, the trade deadline, this is a team, one of those teams that would really super benefit from making a trade for a frontline or even a mid-rotation starter to kind of solidify what they already have. I'm perfectly fine putting Gray at the front of the rotation, even when you get into the playoffs and saying this is going to be our guy. But I think they need one or two more arms behind him that have some experience, have some reliability to go with all the great young guys that they have on the come up. Where's the room for that?
Yeah, I
Like
mean,
they could maybe swap Ian Desmond and his contract. I don't worry about them being able to pay the price in prospects. I worry about them being able to pay the price in dollars. And then you start thinking about, well, okay, so say they're in that position this year, they can't afford to add a bunch of payroll. Then you're starting to talk about trading away guys like McMahon and Rodgers and those young players, and you're shortening your window. So having
right.
a little extra cash and not having this Desmond contract on the books is the kind of thing that actually could have a really substantial effect, maybe on their initial, like whether they're willing to trade for a starter, or maybe whether they'll be able to keep some of these prospects that they've got in their hands if they look to contend. So I think that's it's really interesting how that might work out for them.
Yeah, and I do wonder if perhaps the bullpen activity they did, they went out there and they signed Wade Davis, brought back Chick McGee, also added Ryan Shaw. I wonder if that was sort of hedging against the idea that they're going to go out there and get a frontline starter.
Right.
Maybe they're just one of those teams who don't believe that the value add of adding, a number two or better is really worth the effort. But, we say that, and then who knows? Come July, maybe they try to take on Cole Hamels' contract or something, or what's left of it. Maybe they do something like that where it's a short-term addition and they're able to, make a short-term financial commitment that doesn't necessarily cost them as much in prospects and still allows them to wiggle out from underneath it. Whereas, you sign a free agent starter who's a number two or better, and you're talking probably what, 6, 7 years, maybe, I don't know. Depends on who it is, obviously, but maybe that's the goal, is to go out there and acquire a short-term fix rather than, something sexy and something that could perhaps, be like a dynasty-like situation. Not that I think the Rockies are on that level, but, we always think about 3 to 5 years. We always want a good team for 3 to 5 years, and realistically, it's really hard to, field a team that's that good for 3 to 5 years. So maybe there is something to be said about taking that short-term view on these things.
Well, and if you want to put it that way, I mean, the Rockies' first year of that 3 to 5 years was last year,
Yeah, that's
because they were
true.
pretty good last year. So, if you get 3 years out of this franchise, then 3 years, in the wild card, contending for the top of the National League West, making playoff appearances, I don't think you can really fault that idea if you want to go short term.
Yeah.
You brought up Cole Hamels pitching in Colorado. That is an absolutely fascinating discussion that we probably don't have time for. I really would be interested to see what Cole Hamels looks like pitching in Colorado.
Still handsome.
Well, still handsome, but like I almost think that his approach would serve him very well in Colorado. I think he might have an easier time adapting than others, but who knows? What do I know?
Right.
But
I
yes.
mean, I was just throwing a name out there. That's the one that came to mind, but I'm going to pretend that it was well thought out and I just didn't go for the biggest name that my mind chucked at me. So,
It's a
yes.
super fun name. I really like that. I
Yes.
think we may have some more Cole Hamels discussion as the year goes on, for sure. Depending on how Texas looks, and if they continue to have a rough start to the season. But we got to move on. We've got to talk about another extension, another really interesting one, but for very, very different reasons. And that's the Phillies' extension of Scott Kingery, which they signed the young player to an extension before he made a major league appearance, taking the John Singleton route. With Scott Kingery, what are the actual stats on that deal? I think it was 6 years and 28 million, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's actually a little less than that because I did something yesterday on Matt Chapman, and the richest deal signed by the five players with less than a year of service time over the last 5 years was something like 24 to 26 million. So basically, if you're signing an extension as a player with less than a full year of service time, you're probably getting around 20 to 25 million guaranteed. And Kotz does say 6 years, 24 million. With a couple of clubs' options, those options are valued at 13, 14, and 15 million. So, could potentially, push it up quite a bit higher. But I think we can both agree this is going to be one of those deals where, presuming Kingery plays up to most of his potential, the Phillies are going to walk away with a ton of surplus value. And that's why they're willing to hand this deal out to someone who had, at the time, not even appeared in a big league game during the regular season. So, our listeners know everything there is about that stuff. And, I hope this doesn't become a trend either, I'll say. I said earlier I didn't want players fearing free agency. I don't want players fearing the arbitration process because that's not good for the game either.
Yeah, like I'm of mixed emotions. I tend to really want teams to sign their best players to extensions rather than let them hit free agency. That's something I always want to see. What throws me is that when teams sign, and it's even better when it's young players, guys you can build around, guys you can get excited about. But this doesn't actually extend really Kingery's tenure with the Phillies in any way, which is something as a fan I would like to see. If the Phillies were signing Scott Kingery to a 15-year contract, wow, maybe that's something I could get excited about as a fan. But all this does is it gives the Phillies cost control and probably a discount on his performance over the time when he would already be affiliated anyway. So, as a fan, I don't see this as a positive. As a player focused, somebody who's interested in the players' benefits over the massive corporations that own baseball teams' benefits, I'm obviously disappointed because I don't think this is going to be an accurate or close to what he would have made in a free market. So that frustrates me a little bit. But I do want to just talk about this from a player performance and value standpoint as well. I think this is a really great deal. I think that Kingery was coming up as one of those players who had a relatively high floor, but also a pretty high ceiling. to start off this year with the Phillies, he's hit fine. He hit for enough power so that, you know, his inability to get on base so far, which wasn't really a problem in the minors, he's got a good hit tool, is playing up, and he's playing every sort of position for the Phillies. You never want to call somebody the next Ben Zobrist.
Oh
Don't do it.
no.
Don't
Don't do
do
it.
it. But
Don't
you
do it.
better believe that Gabe Kapler wants a Ben Zobrist on his team.
I mean, everyone wants a Ben Zobrist on their
Yeah,
team,
but
right?
Gabe Kapler wants it more than everybody else, I think. A guy coming up, you know, as kind of that Rays and Dodgers, you know, way of thinking, a guy who literally played with Ben Zobrist, I would bet that that is influencing how he's being deployed and what his thinking is quite a bit. And you're seeing it. I mean, so far this season, he started, Kingery has started at second, third, shortstop, left field and right field. He's played all those positions, but he's also been hitting at all sorts of interesting places in the lineup, mostly in the sixth spot, but they've hit him lead off, they've hit him in the fifth spot, they've hit him third a couple of times. You know, this is obviously a guy that the Phillies are super psyched about, and not just because he's cheap.
Yeah, and you're right. He really raised his stock over the last year too. I mean, before last season, I don't think he was as well. I know he wasn't as highly regarded as he was entering this year, but I guess that's the effect of hitting 26 home runs across the high, upper minors while getting on base nearly 36% of the time will do for you. So yeah, he's a really interesting player. He looks like he could. I mean, if they just left him at second base or wherever, he would probably be, you know, one of the better players of that position. He's going to bounce around a bit, which in theory can actually make him more underrated because, you know, with Zobrist, we saw throughout his career, he would get penalized for playing left field innings. Whereas if he would have just played second base every day, the positional adjustment would have been kinder to him and his overall numbers would be better. So we got to figure out a way to, you know, take that stuff into account and make sure that these players are not getting penalized for being so flexible and being so trusted at multiple positions, both on the dirt and in the grass. But beyond that, I guess it's disappointing because the Phillies are not going to have any issues paying this guy his market value once he gets into his free agent years. So, I mean, you know, every team would have done this if given the chance. So I get it. It's just, yeah, I hope this doesn't become a trend either where, you know, top prospects are facing the decision at the end of spring training. Do you want to go to the minors for a month, or do you want to sign this piece of paper that guarantees you know, 20 to 25 million that also takes away, you know, 3 of your free agent years if we think you're good enough for that? So I know that's not really Scott Kingery specific, but we're starting off here with two concerning things if they become trends, I guess, is what I'm really worried about. But let's get back to the baseball side of things because you're not bailing me out at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to because what you're saying is important and it needs to be said. That free
whatever.
agency is challenging and it's really not player centric and it's not probably not a good thing for baseball. But I like extensions, man. I like the fact that Charlie Blackman is going to play in Colorado maybe until he's done with his career because the alternatives to that are, you know, guys moving on and, you know, not really getting the opportunities that maybe we want to see as fans of them, you know, playing out the whole string for a team. You know, you get things like you could say, you know, some of these players that move on, like Jimmy Rollins never got to finish his career as a Philly, and you want to see guys, you know, continue to do that. Heck, I mean, the Rockies have shown a lot of interest in retaining faces of the franchise. You can point to the Carlos Gonzalez signing this offseason, which I never would have guessed would have happened. And probably that to me seemed like if any move this offseason was a thing for the fans, that might have been it. But
Yeah.
who knows?
Well, I agree. I want to see guys stay with their teams. I just want to see them pay their market value. But more importantly, I just learned that Scott Kingery's nickname is Scotty Jetpacks. And now I don't know why we would talk about anything else because BREF has his name as Scotty Jetpacks and his Twitter handle is Scotty Jetpacks. So
That's awesome. That is a great name for a
wow.
guy with some speed and some ability to launch a ball. That's pretty great.
Let's just talk about that for the next, you know, 30 minutes or what have you. Or we
Or
can transition to the sadder side of things, as if we haven't already been depressing enough, by talking about some injuries that have happened over the first almost 3 weeks of the season. I guess we're going to go back to St. Petersburg because Kevin Kiermaier will miss approximately 13 weeks. That's an oddly specific number
Yes.
after after tearing a ligament in his thumb on a slide. Kiermaier was off to a horrible start this season at the plate. However, you know, the Rays are now going to turn to some concoction that involves Johnny Field. That is his real name, yes. Carlos Gomez, Malik Smith, and I assume at some point they'll bring up Jeremy Hazelbaker. This is not a good situation. This is not a good team. And for Kiermaier, it's a continuation of a trend where he really just can't stay on the field for very long. He appeared in 98 games last season, 105 in 2016. He did get into 151 in 2015, but I guess at this point I have to ask, do you think Kiermaier will ever appear in, you know, more than 100, 110 games heading forward, or is his all-out style and maybe the trop turf going to make him a player who we just have to accept will miss 50-plus games every season?
Nope. I think that after the Rays trade him away this offseason, I think that he will get plenty of playing time for another team. And he'll, you know, I can, oh my gosh, can I see him taking over in center field for the Dodgers and putting in 150 games and playing good defense and, you know, everything looking just hunky-dory for him. But no, as long as he's playing for the Rays and as long as he's doing the things that he does, you know, leveraging his speed, which makes him a good baseball player, he's going to leverage his speed in a way that injures him, is what it appears. But yeah, I'm really disappointed to see this because I like Kiermaier's ability. I like his presence on the field. There are some things that make me not a huge fan of him personality-wise. And in addition to that, he was one of the only good things to watch about this Rays team this year.
Yeah, it's basically Kiermaier, Yonny Chirinos, and Chris Archer. With regards to Kiermaier and trading him, that was one of my hot takes, I think, entering the season, is that they should have traded him because you combine his freaky deaky athleticism, you combine his all-out mentality on the field, you combine the fact that he is already in his age 28 season, you combine that Tropicana field turf. I feel like there's a real chance that if he loses a little bit of this athleticism, well, more than a little bit, but once he starts losing athleticism, I don't think you're going to keep him in center field very long because he's not someone who – he's not Jackie Bradley Jr. You know, his baseball IQ, his baseball skills, whatever you want to call him out there, they are not elite level. He is someone who definitely makes up for his – you know, reads and whatnot with his freaky deaky athleticism. So it's almost like a Carl Crawford situation where you're going to want him in a corner once he starts to slow down a little bit. And reasonably speaking, again, he's in his age 28 season. He's been playing on that turf consistently. We might be a year or two away from him perhaps sliding down the defensive spectrum, as crazy as that sounds. Now, I'm probably going to be wrong. He's probably going to play good center field for the next 5 years, 10 years, whatever. But that's just my fear if I am the Rays or if I am someone who's looking at this from an unbiased perspective. That said, I don't know if they will trade him because, you know, the contract is pretty sweet and the Rays have like nothing else to offer their fans in terms of names. You got to figure Chris Archer will be on the move this year. The most Kiermaier will ever be paid is $12 million, and that's not until 2022 unless, you know, they pick up the club option for 2023. So I don't know. I would certainly be curious to see what they could get for Kiermaier, and I do think it's something they should consider, even though I'm someone who's railed on them for taking back light returns on basically everyone else they traded this winter.
Yeah, I don't buy that Archer's on the move.
You don't?
Nope, not this year. I think he's going to be traded next year. He's only at 7 2/3, 7.6, 7.7 million for 2019. I think the Rays are too smart to trade him when he's that cheap.
See, I actually want him to be traded for his own sake.
Oh, so do I. Get him out of Tampa.
Yes. Trade Yonny Chirinos to a good team, too, while we're at it.
Because I actually Jacob Faria, like they should all get them all away from this team. This team is terrible. But I think that the Rays front office, honestly, is too smart to, unless they get like an FU offer this offseason. You talk about Kiermaier being kind of cheap for his, you know, in terms of a contract. The thing about Kiermaier is Kiermaier's got four more seasons on his deal after this one. They're paying him through 2022. The contract goes up in time. They may need to trade him now in order to get out from that contract ever. Just like you're saying, if he keeps getting injured and stuff, nobody's going to take him in 2020 when he's getting paid $10 million to play left field.
Right.
But with Archer, like, it just, it screams to me that the Rays will trade him at the July deadline next year.
Okay, so let me ask this, because this was a question posed to me when I went on Effectively Wild for the Rays preview. Basically, okay, we both acknowledge Chris Archer has some of the best stuff in baseball. You know, that fastball slider combination is fantastic. He's a great athlete. Seems like a very, very likable individual off the field. Smart guy, so on and so forth. Over the last two seasons, and this is a point raised by Brent Honeywell as well, as funny as it is to say that, Chris Archer has posted ERA pluses of 100 and 101. Through four starts this season, his ERA is near 8. So, you know, the peripherals are good, but at some point, does that ERA, you know, whatever your advanced metric of choice disparity, does that influence his market downward? Like, do you think teams will hold this against them and they will actually get less of a return because of it? Or are teams past even using ERA in negotiations?
No, I do think it should. I actually kind of think it should affect his market value down a little bit. I don't think it should affect it down a dramatic amount. When I look at Chris Archer, I see a guy who is a number one starter at times and a number three starter at times. And the thing about Archer, though, is he has thrown 200-ish innings over the last 4 years. His strikeout rate has been basically the same. His walk rate has been basically the same, and his ground ball rate has been basically the same, last year being a bit of a blip there. The peripherals are all good enough at that level to make me think that he's going to continue to be consistent and he's going to continue to be good. But to me, I see the ERA as something that you probably have to take as part of the package, that he may consistently post an ERA closer to 4 than closer to 3. It doesn't keep him from being an extremely valuable asset and the type of guy that any team would be smart to trade for, no matter what his contract is. But I do think that you do have to look at that honestly about, and you know, ERA, we can make the argument I would much prefer teams look at his runs or his RA9, his average runs per nine, because I think that's a better metric.
That makes him look much worse, though.
It
Over the
does, but
last
that.
two seasons, he's at 4.47 and 4.52 runs per nine.
Right. And that's important to look at. I agree that you should look at that and say that there is something about him that we have to discount his peripherals a little bit because he can't keep runs off the board the same way other people can. So I think that's worth looking at, and I think teams should value him down based on that. If you do that, he is still an extraordinarily valuable pitcher.
Sure. And, you know, the upside there is that you look at that stuff and you look at, you know, the command profile, you know, he checks the boxes and so on and so forth. And you would almost, as weird as it sounds, say he has, you know, the kind of upside that, you know, even if he taps into it a little bit, well, suddenly that contract is, you know, one of the best in baseball again. So it's just interesting to me because if you look at BREF's metrics, you know, he was actually below average based on, you know, how they configure their numbers versus the expectation for runs allowed for an average pitcher in the same ballpark with the same defense and blah, 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 blah. All the gory mathematical details that we're not going to cover here. But the point is, that's something that I don't know how many people realize that because Chris Archer, you think of Chris Archer, you think he's a frontline starter that, well, at least I do because, you know, the stuff is so good. And, you know, again, his name value is very strong. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do with him because I think there's a pretty good chance he's gone by July 31st of this year.
Well, I know that you are much closer to a Rays insider than I am,
Please don't say
so.
that. Here's my other thing. We're probably going to end up talking about this at some point because Alex Colomé has looked so bad at times this
Oh my gosh,
season.
yes.
It almost makes you wonder, did the Rays somehow miss the boat on getting peak value for Colomé, Archer, and Kiermaier? Is that possible? Because if so, oh
Oh,
my goodness.
it's definitely possible. It is more than possible. With Colomé, really the issue with him this year so far has been the walks. It's been awful. So I could see him rebounding nicely as time goes on. That having been said, oh my gosh, it's possible. It's certainly possible. I still think that no matter what happens, unless Chris Archer gets Tommy John surgery, the Rays are going to get good value for him when they trade him. And it is a when. It's not an if.
Of course.
It's a when. But I just I don't believe that they'll get nothing for him at this point unless his UCL tears. But
Speaking of which, from
speaking of
column
UCL
A,
tears.
column A to column B, we're going to New York where the Mets are having some catcher issues And, we should start this off by saying the Mets have been fantastic this season, 12-3, first place in the National League East, blah, 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 blah. However, Travis d'Arnaud has underwent Tommy John surgery. He's done. Kevin Pilecki broke his hand. Jose Lobaton and Thomas Nito. You probably have heard of Lobaton because he's been around a few years. There's nothing special about him whatsoever other than his appetite for ice cream. Whereas Nito made BP's top 10 list this season based on his defense and his raw pop. Brian, I'm going to give it to you. Break down the situation for the lovely people.
If you didn't expect Travis d'Arnaud to get injured this year, you were making a horrible mistake. If you didn't expect Kevin Pilecki to get injured this year, you were making a horrible mistake. The Mets can suffer through this. I mean, this is not something that's going to tank a team that is firing on all cylinders. It's tough because any team that watches a catcher get injured is going to be at a tough position. Yeah, the Mets don't have really great catching depth. Nobody wants to run Jose Lobaton out there for whatever they're going to end up doing. So I'm not super I'm disappointed because I really like Travis d'Arnaud. I actually like Kevin Pilecki more than I did before, but like no team that has two catchers get injured is going to have a good catching situation. It's just not going to happen. Nobody has three good catchers. So as far as the Mets go, yeah, it's a bummer. It's gonna hamper the team for a little bit. But d'Arnaud was kind of getting pushed out for Pilecki a little bit, and Nito was going to have to be called up and get some playing time at some point. To me, the disappointment here is that Travis d'Arnaud not only got injured again. He got a UCL tear, which I've done some research on UCL tears for catchers, and it's certainly not a death sentence, but most of the time it's not a good thing either. And now he's going to be, this is probably his last game for the Mets, has already been played. He's going to go out on the free market. He's going to have to reestablish himself somewhere, and it's not going to be a good scene for him going forward. So I'm bummed out for him. Maybe Travis d'Arnaud now is a left fielder or a first baseman where his bat probably doesn't play.
Oh, we both know Travis d'Arnaud is a future Ray. They're going to put him behind the plate at some point. Frankly, Wilson Ramos might actually end up making sense for the Mets at some point if he ever gets going. But
And
I want to talk.
there's been talk about that. That's a rumor that's been going around for a couple of days now.
Yeah, I was going to mention we need to talk about what they could do there if they end up deciding that Lobaton and Nito are not exactly the dream match behind the plate. Miguel Montero is out there, and I know he's been horrible since leaving the Cubs last summer, but when he was with the Cubs, he was basically a league average hitter who, I believe his framing metrics are still solid. He's not a good thrower, but, again, we're talking about this being a choice between Montero and Nito and Lobaton. So that's one option. Otherwise, they're probably going to have to wait till July unless they put out a blockbuster offer for JT Realmuto, who has had injury issues of his own. So I agree that if you have two catchers get injured, you're not going to have a good situation. But I actually thought this Mets situation was better than, some teams could have run out there. For instance, again, getting back to the Rays, if they lose Ramos and they lose Jesus Sucre, they're running out Kurt Casale and Johnny Manziel. So,
Well, no, they're not. Johnny Manziel is now with the New York Mets.
oh, is he?
Yes.
When
And
did that happen?
it happened 2 days ago. So they brought in Manziel to be their new AAA depth with d'Arnaud out.
Okay, so they're running out.
Exactly. Kurt Casale and a player to be named later, pretty much.
But yeah, I don't honestly know who else would be there because isn't Kufo or however you say his name? I think it's Kufo. Isn't he still suspended? So they'd be maybe Adam Moore, Brett Sullivan. Actually, Brett Sullivan's a nice little sleeper prospect. But nonetheless, yes. So the point is, Lobaton, nothing special, typical third catcher type. But Nito, I actually am very interested in. And I think that situation is better than it could be because, again, you could be running out guys who don't even belong as third catchers anymore. That said, I think the Mets will be fine as well.
And
And
I don't see them going out and getting somebody, given that Pilecki is more of a short-term injury issue, and they were kind of hoping that he would continue to develop anyway. If you see that Pilecki does not come back from the injury, then I think that might be the time for them to look at the market and say, okay, is a Wilson Ramos going to be a good fit? There's a very interesting fit, I think, with the Padres in Austin Hedges. There are some other players that I think they could go out and get, but until we prove that Kevin Pilecki is either bad or going to continue to be hurt, it doesn't make sense for them to go get somebody.
I'll throw out another name. I'm going to end up being disliked by Rangers fans by the end of this podcast, it seems. But if you're the Texas Rangers and your season continues to go the wrong direction, and, you know, the Mets call you up and they ask about Robinson Chirinos, you probably have to consider trading him. He is, you know, 33. He'll be 34 in June. He's been an above-average hitter the last few seasons, although he has injury issues of his own. And on his contract, he has just next season at $2.375 million. It's a team option, which is a really nice team option if you believe in the bat. So maybe that would make sense, trying to move him before, you know, his expiration date, so to speak, kicks in. And, you know, maybe you get an interesting arm or whatever in return. But that's one name that I would throw out there who might be available come July.
I really like that move for the Rangers. I think that's very smart. I'm not sure how the fit is for the Mets, but I think it's a great idea for the Rangers because the Rangers also have Cameron Rupp now. And I think if you're not really super psyched about competing this year, Rupp's a fine guy to plug in instead of Chirinos as a catcher. You don't need to, if you're not really itching to try to get every last bit of performance out of your team, I think Rupp would be a fine replacement.
Yeah, we're both Rupp riders, it seems like. But you mentioned Austin Hedges earlier, and we can transition now to talking about Hedges' team, because a big injury happened there with Dennison Lamet, a DFA podcast topic of note a few times last season. He'll miss the season as well with Tommy John surgery, and I guess we can talk about him before we talk about his replacement, because Lamet is a guy who I think at first we differed on. I saw the fastball-slider combination, and I was intrigued, and I thought that he could potentially become a mid-rotation starter. I think you were a little bit more conservative and thought that he would end up in the bullpen, and, you know, this injury certainly might push him in that direction a little quicker. But I don't know. It's a shame to see him miss the season, because there was supposedly some hype during spring about him developing a third pitch, and now we're going to have to wait at least another year, maybe a little bit longer, depending on how slowly they take his rehab, before we really see how that worked out during the regular season. But this is a blow for the Padres.
Oh, yeah, it's a huge one. And don't get me wrong. I actually thought Lamet was going to be a fine option as a middle-of-the-rotation type of starter. What I was worried about was there were a lot of folks that seemed to be talking about him like, oh, he's striking out the world. He's going to be a real front-of-the-rotation starter. And that so I thought sense. It was much, much more likely that he would either settle into the middle of the rotation and be one of those guys who throws like 150 or 160 innings as a starter and have some great outings and some miserable ones, or he might move back to the bullpen. But the general idea of what you said is absolutely right. There was a lot to get excited about with him, and yeah, it's really a bummer that he's going to be out. The Padres don't have a pitcher to lose, well, you think, and then Joey Lucchesi comes up.
And he is really interesting. He has that herky-jerky lizard on a fence post style delivery. He has the weird, I've heard it called a changeup. It looks like a breaking ball. It has breaking ball velocity, but apparently it's his changeup. And, you know, he's basically, I think, a two-pitch guy. Fastball and then that changeup thing. And it's really interesting to watch. And he kind of came out of nowhere because I don't know. I don't think he was on prospect list entering the season, at least. Oh, he was ninth on BA's list, but he wasn't ranked on BP's list. So fair enough, but he is really fun to watch.
Yeah, it's really interesting with him because he is a guy who manages to do a really nice job limiting his walks last year in the minors. He did a really nice job of that. He's done that again this year. But to me, he seems like maybe like a little bit of a higher upside version of Lamet, where I do have a lot of concerns, especially as a two-pitch guy, but also because he's a younger guy without a lot of mileage on his arm, that he could end up being one of these guys who can only throw about 150 innings a year. I look at him as a lot like, you know, what we might, his upside to me is like Lance McCullers.
Right.
And so that's
a good upside, though, to be fair.
That's a heck of an upside. But I don't want people to start drafting him in fantasy leagues or talking about him like he's going to be Chris Archer.
Right. Right. But it's interesting because I think we both, like you say, 150 innings. And the crazy thing is, if you looked at that Astros team last season, you know who led them in innings, right?
Was it McCullers?
No. Keep going.
Brad Peacock.
No, you're not. I don't know if you're gonna get this, quite frankly, because it's not someone you expect at all. It's not someone who's still on their team.
Mike
It's not
Fiers.
someone who.
Mike Fiers.
Yes, Mike Fiers led the
Who's.
world champions in innings with 153.
I mean, that is surprising to me. It is surprising.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to
Yes.
happen this year, but
If
yeah.
it does, congratulations to the Detroit Tigers
But I
because that
mean,
is.
that I think was kind of an odd outlier type season. It's you're right. You can succeed without having pitchers who throw 200 innings on your team, but I will be absolutely shocked this year if the Astros don't have two guys who throw 190 plus innings.
I agree with that. I was just making the point that, we're thinking of this sort of with the lens of how we grew up in baseball, where, you wanted your ace throwing 200 innings and whatnot. Actually, you wanted your ace throwing more than 200 innings when we were, we're not too far removed from the days where, you might want 220 plus. But I guess with the way baseball is shifting now, 150 is no longer an insult
No,
that it
it's
was
not.
when we were growing up. Like 150 innings, you're like, well, that's not exactly what you want. Well, now 150 innings might actually put them, top three on the staff, which is crazy to me. But, I'm just making that point that with baseball shifting parameters with what they want from starting pitchers, that that's not no longer, excuse me, that's no longer a deal breaker like it was, maybe 15, 20 years ago. So it's kind of interesting to watch that. And I also say that I'm glad to see Robbie Erlin back in the Padres rotation because I liked him quite a bit a few years back. He's battled with health issues and now, he's back, and that's cool to see because, again, I was a Robbie Erlin fan, and he's not going to change their dynamics too much. He's one of those mid to back rotation starters, and who knows how long he stays healthy, but he's already thrown 14 innings this season, and over the last 3 seasons, excuse me, yes, over the last 3 seasons, he only had 32 innings combined at the big league level. So that's cool. Hopefully, he stays healthy.
Yeah, I'm all in on Robbie Erlin. It's funny because Robbie Erlin is by far the longest tenured Padres player, which is
Yes, you did a
bizarre
piece
to
on
think
this. Plug
about.
your piece. Plug your piece.
Yeah, that's it's something I write every year is which player is longest tenured with all of their teams, and Erlin is the Padres were nowhere near anybody with the tenure of Erlin, which is really weird to think about considering the guy mostly doesn't pitch.
Yep. Anything more on the Padres, or do you want to shift to AJ Preller's old team?
We can talk a little bit about the Rangers and Elvis Andrus because I think that matters. Andrus has really come on as I would say maybe the most vital player on the Rangers over the last couple of years, and now he's gone
Yeah,
for a little while at least.
and that takes down the fun factor of this team. It also takes down their talent level. And this has been a rough stretch for the Rangers because Odor is on the disabled list. Jurickson Profar left last night's game of an injury. They're going to start having to dig deep, I mean, deeper than they've already dug in order to fill those middle infield slots. And, it's starting to feel like one of those seasons, what, 2 years ago when the Rangers had a ton of injuries and it just wiped out their year. Well, if they're not at that point already, they're getting very close to it. Now, they did bring up someone who I'm pretty interested in, Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. I think I butchered that. Let me try that again. Kiner Falefa. There we
Yep.
go. All
Yep,
right,
there you
so
go.
he hasn't hit at all, but in the minors, he was playing some middle infield. He was also catching, which is something interesting. The Rangers have another guy in their minor league system who kind of does the same thing. So I know this has very little to do with Elvis Andrus, but I'm almost wondering if they are putting together the blueprint for the new utility infielder. Maybe you have to catch a little bit as well, sort of in the Austin Barnes mold, where, if you're a passable catcher, maybe that opens up the bench a little bit. You can use them as your backup if you have a strong number one catcher. And I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud here, but that's probably the most interesting thing about the Rangers right now for me.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not a lot of interesting stuff with the Rangers. I actually am a little bit interested in Ronald Guzman to see if he's
Yeah.
gonna come up and hit like he could. But the unfortunate thing here, I think, is that the Rangers have now had a long run of really kind of hyped prospects that haven't exactly panned out the way we would have hoped, going from Profar to Gallo to Mazara, maybe Guzman, maybe not. I'm really kind of baffled as to why none of these guys seem to be working out. Even Odor, who had a nice strong start to his career and is a legitimate solid major leaguer, has been really on a downturn the last year, which is a crazy thing to say for a guy who's 24.
Right.
But going back to Andrus, Andrus is, you know, again, one of those guys who's the longest tenured player on his team. But Andrus is a special player. And one of the things I think kind of underscores how special he is that if everything, the Mets fans in particular talk a lot about Ahmed Rosario and how he has the potential to be a superstar kind of player. And if everything breaks right for Ahmed Rosario, a good outcome, a great outcome would be Elvis Andrus.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good outcome for any shortstop. Over the
But
last few seasons, Andrus has really turned into, because early in his career, the talk was when they signed him to that extension, it was like, oh, the bat will come along. And then he went through a 3-year stretch where he couldn't hit at all. I mean, he was hitting worse than he had hit before then. And now, the last 2+ years, he's turned into an above average hitter. Last year, he hit 20 home runs. He's only got 57 home runs for his career. So that's crazy.
Well, and I mean, to kind of make things even more crazy, I know it's just the start of the season, but he had remarkably raised his walk rate, which was like the last thing he wasn't doing as an offensive player before he got injured. So I'm just really hoping that he's able to recover sooner rather than later. This contract, which at the time looked to be 8 years and 120 million, people were just shaking their heads like, why would you sign this guy to this contract when you got Jerks and Profar coming? And why would you sign this guy to this contract when you've got, you know, other players who could play really well in the middle infield? It's going to continue to look like a bargain, and there's like 4 more years on it after this.
Yeah, he could potentially be in Texas through the 2023 season, and he will not make more than 15.25 million at any point during it, depending on if the option vests and whatnot. So yeah, it's been a fun little career arc for him, and credit to him. Speaking of, well, I guess this
Let's
would not be a
go through a couple
fun.
of other injuries really, really quickly because some of
Yes.
them don't really dramatically affect a team's long-term outlook. Alex Gordon has gone down with an injury for the Royals. The Royals were already a wasteland, and Gordon, you know, it's sad to see him get injured, but this is not really going to move the needle, right?
And this is the unfortunate underbelly of, sometimes teams holding on to their own guys as you get to see the decline phase. And he's going to be paid $20 million next season, Brian. And he has been horrible. Like, there is at least $24 million coming his way in 2019, assuming they buy out his 2020 option. So he's going to make something like $44 million between now and the end of his line in Kansas City, and he has just been awful since returning from free agency.
Yeah, I don't see him. He's unplayable now when
Yeah.
he's healthy, which is a shocking thing to imagine. You know, you expect guys to have decline phases, but nobody saw this coming, and it's really unfortunate. I really hope he gets another chance to try to right the ship a little bit before he kind of ends his career and sails off into the sunset.
Yep. And then over in Pittsburgh, Josh Harrison will miss something like 6 weeks. He broke his hand after being hit by a pitch on Sunday. I assume they're going to slot Adam Frazier and Sean Rodriguez in at the Keystone. Frazier is a nice little player.
Yeah, he sure is. The thing here is that I was shocked that the Pirates didn't trade Josh Harrison this offseason. They traded all their other kind of more expensive good players, and now they really could pay for it. I know he's going to come back from this injury, but they probably should have sold him when they had the chance. And it'll be nice to see Frazier get some run. I think he'll do well for them.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think Harrison will retain his value, though. There's something to be said about his versatility, his spark plug nature, and whatnot. I think he's, a 3-win player, probably.
Yeah, maybe. He
Maybe.
has been in the past for sure.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think they could still find a taker for him if they wanted to. But I guess I can say I appreciate if they valued his intangibles enough to keep him around. I appreciate that, even if it might cost them a little bit on his value.
I agree completely. The only thing is, you know, since it's a hand injury, I always get worried about power coming back, and I always worry about bat control. And bat
Yeah.
control is a huge part of Harrison's game.
That's basically his game.
Yeah, it
That and
really is.
trying hard.
Sometimes he can power one over the fence, but it's the bat control.
Yeah. And over in Arizona, you have Taijuan Walker on the disabled list. The Diamondbacks really didn't need this. Starting pitching depth has been sort of a problem for them, let's say, for the last few years. They already have Shelby Miller out. Randall Delgado is also on the disabled list, so you can't even kind of slot him into the rotation. They traded Anthony Banda, so I guess they're probably going to look to Braden Shipley, you think? Troy Scribner, maybe Matt Cock.
Shipley would probably be my guy. I actually am less worried about this for the Diamondbacks, honestly, because they've gotten off to a great start to the season. Walker wasn't effective when he was pitching, for sure. And I think that given the fact that they have such good starters already on the books in Corbin and Ray and Greinke and Zach Godley, who, again, every time I say Zach Godley, I have to be like, where'd this guy come from? But I do think that since they have such good talent already in the rotation, they can absorb this a little bit, and they should take the time to figure out how to get Walker right, whether it's rehab or something like that. Obviously, if he's out for a real extended period, 3 months, something like that, the season, it's going to be a bad thing because Tylan Walker's a decent pitcher. But, again, this is also a team that can go out in the middle of the season and get somebody to fill in.
Yeah, and two other names I should have mentioned there. Chris Medlin, who used to be a favorite of mine. Hopefully he gets a chance and makes the most of it. And also Taylor Clark, who was one of their better prospects and could conceivably join the rotation mid-season if needed. And I think that's all we really have to say about that one. Josh Donaldson on the disabled list for the Blue Jays early in the season. He just could not throw the baseball at all. I mean, it was really bad on opening day. But the Blue Jays have gotten off to a pretty solid start, and Donaldson doesn't seem like he's going to be down for long. I will say, we like the Blue Jays' depth additions during the winter of Yungarvis Solarte and Diaz was whatever, I think, in both of our opinions, but they look really smart for going out there and getting Solarte.
Yeah, for sure. Again, I'm not an Aledmys Diaz guy. I think that we've got a position here where if I'm the Blue Jays and we are getting off to a decent start, I seriously consider being very aggressive right here and making Josh Donaldson the designated hitter and calling up little Vlad Guerrero.
There you go. I don't have anything really to add to that, but that would be very fun. And then the last injury we want to talk about, J.C. Ramirez for the Angels will miss the rest of the season with Tommy John surgery. It's a bummer because Ramirez was a pretty fun story. He kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, I don't even think he was really making an impression with the Reds the last few years, which you can't make an impression on the Reds pitching staff. You probably are not a big league pitcher. And yet, Ramirez surfaced in Anaheim slash L.A., and he was fun to watch with that, high velocity fastball, the cutter. Unfortunately, the Angels rotation and the health of the rotation will be kind of what dictates their season. And in the early going, they've had some issues. I mean, they've already had three starters hit the DL. It's two now because Andrew Heaney is back, but you're seeing them dig into their depth, and that'll be something to watch the rest of the way.
Yeah, the thing about the Angels, we've said this all along, if everything breaks right for the pitching, they're a really, really great team. Now, the loss of Ramirez by itself, not a huge deal, but it makes them even thinner, and it's going to be the next injury that really hurts them. But, Shohei Ohtani is apparently the greatest pitcher who's ever lived, so that helps.
Yes, it does. And that's it for the injury portion of our show. We're going to run through some transactions that we missed, signings, waiver claims, all the fun stuff. And the biggest name of the bunch was Greg Holland signing a 1-year, $14 million deal with the Cardinals. Everyone kind of expected him to end up in St. Louis. He just took the scenic route to get there. This makes a ton of sense for them, even though he kind of struggled in the early going.
I was going to say, kind of struggled is putting it very, very nicely. His debut with the Cardinals was one of the worst debuts you could have possibly imagined for a new closer to go third of an inning, walk four players, give up an earned run. I mean, that was truly an unfortunately an awful start to his Cardinals career. Things got better. Yes.
I
Go
would
ahead.
blame the team a little bit, though, for putting him in that situation.
Yeah, he didn't look like he was ready.
Right. So, it stinks for Greg Holland, and his numbers will reflect that. But yeah, I don't blame him for that. Eddie Romero went to the Pirates on a waiver claim. I like this. Eddie is a live arm. I was surprised the Nationals gave up on him so quickly because he had a solid season last year, statistically. And yeah, it reunites Eddie Romero with Felipe.
Vasquez.
Vasquez, yes. I wanted to make sure I got that right, and then I blanked. Felipe Vasquez, they were together in the Rays system, kind of paired because of their names and whatnot. So I like the steal a lot for the Pirates, given the low cost.
I'm usually the lower guy on any Romero. I don't think he's a special reliever. I think he's a fine, fill in as your second lefty or third lefty in a bullpen. That having been said, he's basically free, and the Pirates can sometimes get a little bit more out of these guys than others, so good for them.
Yep. And speaking of former Rays who disappoint Brian, Jeremy Hellickson is back in the majors. He's with the Washington Nationals. He made his debut last night, 4 2/3 innings, 7 hits, 2 runs, a walk, and 3 strikeouts. Hellickson actually, it's kind of funny to think he got the qualifying offer of the offseason before last because he was so bad with Baltimore that I guess he basically was not desired by anyone because this is the. I mean, he just signed, what, a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, something like that. And yeah, he's already in the majors. They're basically saying he's better than AJ Cole. That seems like a very low bar to top, but we'll see.
Yeah, this is fun because that line that you just read off for Jeremy Hellickson is like the most Jeremy Hellickson line I could think of. Like, oh, he kept the ball, he limited his walks, he didn't strike anybody out, he wound up being like moderately effective despite the peripherals looking super ugly. So yeah, all he needed to do that he didn't was give up a home run, and since he didn't, he won. So good for him.
That's the difference between winning and losing in the majors is whether or not Jeremy Hellickson gives up that home run. A fun one in New York because the Yankees had outrighted Jace Peterson. He rejected that outright assignment, decided to become a free agent, and subsequently re-signed with the Yankees because of a he was given a more lucrative slit contract. Peterson spent a few years in Atlanta after being traded from the Padres. He's fine. He's whatever. I don't think anything major needs to be said here. The Yankees are dealing with a lot of injury issues, and it's not yet time to bring up Gleyber Torres. So that's about all I have to say on that.
Yeah, the Peterson thing, I've always been a huge Jace Peterson guy, and I'm just very excited that he's going to be on a major league contract now, which means he'll probably get a little bit more of a look at the major league level than your average guy. He's also not going to play, really, unless there's another injury. I wouldn't expect him. He'll spell Miguel Andujar occasionally, I guess, and that'll probably be it.
He's the second most likable Yankees bench infielder behind Ronald Torres.
I mean, it depends on how you feel about Tyler Austin, so it might be third.
Oh, did you mean wait, did you mean Tyler Wade?
I meant Tyler Austin because Wade's pretty much a starter now, right?
Yeah, and I would put Wade above all of those guys, but Austin, yeah, that's fair. I respected Austin's bat slam. That was aggro to the nth degree. So good for him. Speaking of aggro to the nth degree, Mark Reynolds has finally found a job, and he is also with the Nationals. He's coming off a pair of perfectly fine seasons with Colorado, 101 and 105 OPS plus. He homered 30 times last season. Wasn't good enough to get him a big league job, but he will presumably slot in on the bench at some point for the Nationals to give them the potential for late inning thunder.
The combination of Matt Adams and Matt Reynolds on your bench is just about the most. That is the ultimate pair of bench bats who can do some damage late in the game. I love it. I think it's awesome. They're playing Matt Reynolds at third base. Like, this is extremely my jam. I'm so excited for this.
Yes, and I have nothing to add to that other than Mike Rizzo was very good at his job.
And was
That,
rewarded for that by getting an extension, so good on him.
yes, and that was a no-brainer for the Nationals. I mean, if they let him walk, what are you doing?
Nothing.
Yeah, and then over in San Francisco, the Giants brought up someone who also has a lot of name value, although he was just making his big league debut, Tyler Beatty. You know him as the guy who snubbed the Blue Jays in the 2011 draft, despite being taken 21st overall. He went to Vanderbilt, increased his stock to when he was taken 14th in the 2014 draft. He's made 2 starts, given up 9 hits and 7 runs in 7 2/3 innings. He's walked 8 and struck out 9. Basically, he has a full arsenal of average-ish pitches, but the command has always eluded him, and there's some thought that he would benefit from trimming his arsenal and making it more simplistic for him. Don't know if that's going to be the case because the Giants kind of need him in the rotation at this point, and it's kind of been a disappointment.
Well, I mean, you said that control is an issue for Beattie. In something like less than 8 innings, he has walked more than a batter per inning, so hasn't been fixed yet. But he's been a guy that Giants fans have been looking for a long time, and I'm excited to see what he can do in the major league level. I just hope it's good.
Yeah, Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be good. He might end up in the bullpen for me, but we'll see. Speaking of guys who might end up in the bullpen, Jeremy Hazelbaker is actually with the Durham Bulls right now, so you could say he is, in a sense, in a bullpen. He'll probably make his way to the majors at some point. The Rays acquired him in a small deal in April. He's on the 40-man roster. Once the Rays get done rotating fresh arms through their bullpen, they will probably bring up Hazelbaker to take a spot in the outfield that was vacated by Kevin Kiermaier, although he's not a center fielder. He has had, in 300 career plate appearances, basically, he has 115 OPS plus. No one thinks he's that good. Otherwise, he'd be on someone's bench already. But there you go. There's Jeremy Hazelbaker in a nutshell.
Oh, a hazel nutshell. That's
Yes.
terrible. It's bad. I feel bad for saying it. I feel bad for all of our listeners. Yeah, he was traded for cash considerations. He's not somebody we should expect to be good.
And that's not Kevin Cash considerations. Oh, we have one more, unfortunately. I apologize to all the listeners. The A's ended up grabbing Trace Thompson. Yes, that's Clay's brother, off waivers a few seasons back. He seemed like he could be, at minimum, a decent fourth outfielder. He'll probably get the chance with Oakland, although outside of a fantastic catch, his career in Oakland is off to a little bit of a slow start. He is 1 for 7 with 4 strikeouts. Brian, is there any hope whatsoever of Trace Thompson living up to his Splash Brother lineage, let's say?
Oh my, no. But it's fun that he's in Oakland and he gets to play in the same city as his brother. But the thing about this that was so strange to me was the way his kind of performance fell off a cliff last year in AAA. He was really, really terrible in AAA last year. He's always had approach issues, but I mean they got really dark last season. And when he played with the Dodgers, they were even worse. And when he's been playing with the Athletics, they've been truly, truly awful so far in a short period of time with the team. If there's any team that should be able to fix a guy's ability to take a pitch, you kind of think it would be the Athletics, but he's gotta fix that strikeout issue, otherwise he's in serious trouble.
And I wonder how much of that is to do to his back issues. And by that, I mean his lackluster performance in AAA last season, because I will grant him some leeway with the idea that, yes, it was probably the back that was causing him and his performance to crater. That said, he's already 27 years old. And, this A's group right now, they have Mark Canha. If you listen to DFA number one, I believe we talked about Mark Canha playing center field. So it's nice to circle back to that. But yeah, Mark Canha is their center fielder. They also have Jake Smolinski. And eventually, you have to think Dustin Fowler will be taking over in center field. And, Boog Powell is on the disabled list. So that's why we are not mentioning him. But
The Fowler thing is messing with me. I have not been able to figure out why they didn't go with him to start the season. Now he's not playing well in Nashville, for the AAA team. This is I'm sorry, I just don't get it.
I don't either, Brian. And I think that's probably the part in the show where we need to end our discussion about these wonderful, beautiful transactions. We covered the entire league in 2 weeks and what, an hour, hour and a half. So, all things considered, that wasn't too bad for our first show in a while.
No, not at all. And hopefully you won't have to wait as long for another show. A new episode of the DFA podcast. We'll look to have one for you next week. But RJ, on your behalf, I'd like to thank everybody for listening. And we're hoping we can hear from you guys. You can find us at DFA Podcast on Twitter. You can email us at DFA@baseballperspectives.com. But enjoy the start to your baseball season. Happy April, everybody, and we will catch you guys next time.